This is Missing Peter Zosky in Prince George, broadcasting on CFUR 88.7, and I'm your host, Stuart Parker. Welcome to the February 22nd edition of Missing Peter Zosky in Prince George on CFUR 88.7. Well, today I have a treat for me. I hope it's a treat for you. I've spent pretty much the whole hour interviewing Derek Jensen, one of the most profound, exciting, and controversial voices in this hemisphere on environmental issues, environmental philosophy, and a host of other subjects. Derek's a longtime grassroots environmental activist, author of more than 25 books. He lives in Northern California, where we reached him, Crescent City, and his new book, Bright Green Lies, has just come out, published by Monkfish Publishers. Now, as someone who has been involved in environmental activism and environmental politics for as long as he has, I asked Derek some key questions about the fate of environmental movements and their interactions with systems like capitalism and like the electoral system. And I get some very well-considered answers. So this is not your normal BC Current Affairs Show episode. This is a treat for me and my loyal eco-socialist listeners to get a more in-depth discussion about how to approach the ecological crisis our planet faces. So without further ado, an hour of Derek Jensen. Joining us on the line from Crescent City, California, near the Oregon border, is Derek Jensen, author of more than 25 books, longtime grassroots environmental activist, who has hollowed out some time to talk to folks up here in Prince George. So first of all, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
All right. Now, 25 books, that's a lot of books. I'm interested in your latest entitled Bright Green Lies. It's just come out from Monkfish Publishers. Tell me a little bit about what you're taking on in this new book.
The book really began about 10 years ago when I was asked by a magazine I wrote for at the time to debate this guy who was a bright green. And what a bright green is there are people who believe that this society is not functionally unsustainable, but instead that various tweaks can make it sustainable. And one of the ways this is manifesting these days is a lot of people are believing that wind and solar will save the planet. And wind and solar not only won't save the planet, they can't even power industrial civilization. And so that's one part of the book is taking on a bunch of the various lies that they tell about wind and solar being good for the planet, about how you can make cities sustainable, about how recycling can save the planet. And that's part of it. And then another part of the book is really about the fact that at one point, environmentalism was primarily about protecting wild places and wild beings. And it has been transformed into sustaining this destructive culture. And also, environmentalism has been converted into, if you have 100,000 people, you can get 100,000 people to march on the streets of Washington, D.C. or New York or Paris. And if you ask them why they're marching, they'll say, to save the planet. And if you ask them for their specific demands, they'll say that they want subsidies for the wind and solar industries. And that's an extraordinary coup to turn this mass movement into a lobbying arm of a sector of capitalism. That's just crazy. I mean, I can't, you know, the anti-war movement in Vietnam or against Vietnam be like, well, we want subsidies for, I don't know, school buses or something. And it's just, it's extraordinary that this transformation has taken place. So those are basically what the book's about. And we can talk about, you know, various specific details if you want or not.
No, that's, that opens up a lot. It's funny. I think I might have been around for some of the original cognate of the term bright green. I remember, when I was in the Green Party in British Columbia in the 1980s, we had one member, Angela Price, who wanted us to really repurpose the whole party into using the Canadian tax system, giving out tax receipts for income tax reductions for people to construct compost bins, recycling things, whatever. And then we were supposed to put on the side a sign saying another bright green idea. And so I had always thought that was like an idiosyncratic term. It hadn't occurred to me that this is now like descriptive of a whole sector. Where do you see this as coming from? Like, I mean, we're dealing with all kinds of capture in our present environment. How do you think this capture has been so successful? Why do you think it worked so effortlessly?
Well, that's a great question. I think that there are two big reasons I can think of off the top of my head. One is it gives us a very, a story that we want to hear. And the story that we want to hear is that, that, you know, everything will be okay. All we have to do is give enough money to the solar and wind industries and they will, and that will save the planet. You know, you type in solar will save the planet in an internet search engine and you get, you know, millions of hits. And that's a very comforting idea that we can continue this extravagant lifestyle without, without harming the planet, and B, that we can do it, that we don't have to worry about peak oil either because solar and wind can just step in, which is also not true for reasons we can talk about. And then that's one reason is that it's a very comforting story. And, you know, I am very comfortable saying that one of human's greatest capacities is the capacity for denial and self-deception. And, so it's a nice soothing story. And then the second reason is there's been lots of money that backs it. I mean, solar panels in the first place were developed by, ExxonMobil, or back when it was Exxon. Might have been Standard Oil back then.
Yeah, anyway, their rigs in the Persian Gulf, right?
No, it was way before that. Originally it was developed for space. Because, you know, you need to have a power source out there. Makes sense. Anyway, and then, and the point is that it wasn't, solar panels weren't developed in somebody's backyard and they can't be built in your backyard. They're highly, industrial products that require industrial inputs that require mining, et cetera, et cetera. It's not like, so you mentioned composting earlier and it's not like a compost bin that you can have in your backyard that will, you know, you can throw in your watermelon rinds and take out some soil and put it over the tomatoes. This is an industrial process from beginning to end.
And so, I think one of the things we're coming up against here is that we used to call it when there was a more vibrant green philosophical debate. We used to talk about, what is the central analysis? What do we think the problem is that's causing, the omnicide, that's causing the extinction event? And in a sense then, so the analysis we're up against is, oh, well, the omnicide is being caused because we picked the wrong industrial energy cap. And if we pick a different one, then this won't be happening. Obviously, your analysis suggests the problem is originating elsewhere.
Well, first off, thank you for that summation, which is brilliant and accurate. And second, the reason I sort of smiled there for a second in the middle of that is that's precisely how the debate with this bright green began, is the editor from the magazine asked us to start with what is the problem. And before we even started, I said, I'm not going to do this on the phone. I'm going to do it in writing. And the reason I'm going to do it in writing is because I want to be able to look up facts. And that's what I said. And what I was thinking is, I know the other guy's going to lie. And when he does, I'm not going to have the, you know, it's so hard to defend against a lie in a debate, in a personal debate, because, you know, you have to have every fact at your fingertips. And I've always wanted to say this. And one of my favorite moments ever of watching a debate was Ralph Nader versus Dan Quayle. And at one point, Dan Quayle made an assertion. Ralph Nader said, that's not true. Dan Quayle said, yes, it is. And that's usually where it ends. Mm-hmm. But in this case, Ralph Nader had in his pocket a citation. And it was just glorious. You know, Dan Quayle, assertion. Ralph Nader, no. Dan Quayle, yes. Ralph Nader, here we go. Page 43 of this. Dan Quayle's like, well, you got me. And so I'm not that good. And so I wrote the first thing of what's the problem. And it took the bright green about 5 minutes to write back and say, I've changed my mind. This has to be done on the phone. And you've got it exactly, that I perceive the problem as civilization is a specific way of life that's based on the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. And because linguistically, the word civilization comes from the root civitatis, which means state or city. And historically, when we talk about the rise of civilization, we're not talking about all cultures. We're talking about very specific forms of social organization that arose in the Near East, India, China. And that's nice, Derek, but what's a city? And a city I've defined as people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources, which means that the people living where you live or where I live 800 years ago were not living in cities, because they were living on what the land could give them. The Talua lived where I live now for 12,500 years, and they basically ate salmon and salmon and salmon and then salmon and then salmon. And I'm not saying, this is not any sort of noble savage stuff, I'm not saying they were perfect. What I'm saying is, we know that they lived here sustainably for 12,000 years. And we know that they didn't destroy the land base. Anyway, back to a city. A city is people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. And if you require the importation of resources, that means a couple things. One of them is, your way of living can never be sustainable, because if you require the importation of resources, you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource. And as your city grows, you'll denude an ever larger area. So New York City, where do you get the brick? Where do you get the wood? Where do you get the water? Where do you get the energy? Where do you get the food? It comes from somewhere else. And then where does the poop go? Where do all your waste go? They got to go somewhere else. And so, A, if your way of life is characterized by the growth of cities, they're always based on this smaller area surrounded by a larger area that is the colonies. And then the other thing it means is that your way of life can never be, it must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, it means that trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if you require the importation of resources and the people in the next watershed over won't trade you for it, you're going to take them. And I mean, that's the history of civilization in the last several thousand years, which, to be clear, is not the history of humankind. not every culture has gone this way. This is a specific set of social arrangements. And we can talk about the role of technology and all this. We can do that if you want. We can go wherever you want. Doesn't matter.
So, I mean, one of the things you're talking about, the term that we used to use to govern this debate is scale. That when you hit a certain scale of human habitation, you're reaching outside of your local environment and establishing these adversarial things that you talk about. And this is a critique that's pretty old. I mean, many people would argue that this is essentially the argument that Lao Tzu is making in the Tao Te Ching, right? He's talking about the small country versus the big country. Yep. And how you want a place where the horses haul manure instead of arms and things like that. So it's a venerable civilization critique that you're offering. And when I got involved in green politics in the mid-1980s, this was something that people were conversant with. Not everyone agreed with it. There were all kinds of ideological splits within green politics, certainly at the time. But once somebody said that, everybody would go, oh, now we're debating scale. Now we're talking about this. And one of the things that I found frustrating is we have so much more supposedly environmental concern than we did 35 years ago. And yet, the critical vocabulary that we use to talk about these issues seems to be rarer and rarer if you find yourself in a meeting or trying to do some kind of collective activity based around these principles. So what do you think is, like, why are we losing knowledge, losing terminology in this area rather than gaining it as the situation intensifies?
Well, that's an absolutely brilliant question. And I'm going to give you the first answer that comes to mind, which I think is probably not the correct answer. I'm going to give it to you anyway, which is, I think this might be the correct answer. I think we are collectively losing our minds more and more. And I think I'm thinking of postmodernism, and I'm thinking of a poll that I recently heard of British youth, 17 to 25 or somewhere in there. And they asked, if you had to make a choice, would you rather lose sunlight or Wi-Fi? And they would prefer to keep Wi-Fi. And I think that we are – part of the problem is that we have what Whitehead might have called the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, or what – I would just call bad values or the wrong values. That when you think about the so-called solutions to global warming that are presented in the mainstream, what they all have in common is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is having to conform to industrial capitalism. And that is solving for the wrong variable. That's insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality, because the health of the planet has to be primary, because without a planet, you don't have any social system whatsoever. So all social systems are dependent upon the health of the planet. But we've got that backwards. And part of the reason we have it backwards is because of our experience. This is not just some bad philosophy, although it's bad philosophy too. But our experience is that our food comes from the grocery store and our water comes from the tap. And if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from the tap, you'll defend to the death the system that brings those to you, because your life depends on it. This is not abstract theory. This is dying of starvation. And on the other hand, if your experience is that your food comes from a land base and your water comes from a river, you'll defend to the death those. And it's been the insertion of the system between us and the source of life has been both just a thing that has happened, and it also in some cases has been intentional, by which I mean there was an interesting debate between an 1830s pro-slavery philosopher in Louisiana and his northern abolitionist buddy. And the Southerner said, look, we would get rid of our slaves in a heartbeat if we could arrange land ownership conditions that were economically feasible for us, because it all boils down to whether you want to have slavery or capitalism, slavery or non-slavery capitalism, it boils down to land situation, that if you have a lot of land and not many people, then people have access to land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means the only way you can get them to work for you is at the point of a gun. On the other hand, if you have a lot of people and not much land, like in a city, the people don't have access to food, which means that they have to go to work for you for whatever pittance that you want to offer them. So he said, if you could arrange land ownership conditions like that down here, we'd let all the slaves go in a heartbeat, because then we wouldn't have to pay for them when they're old or young or sick. And likewise, the laws of apartheid were written not just because white people hated black people, but instead, I mean, yes, that's under lies, but they were written explicitly because they wanted to have workers in their mines, and the local people were living in subsistence economies that didn't have cash. No reason for cash when you're living in a community of a small scale community, 120 people, and you've got cows and you've got yams and you've got whatever else you eat. And so they wanted to drive people in wage economy. They started making poll taxes, hut taxes, dog taxes. And so people had to get cash, which means somebody's got to go to work. And so the point, and this is true for abusive relationships too, where, you know, a lot of times abusers will cut off they can control the person they're abusing through finances. And the system itself is doing that too, where I have to go to the grocery store to buy food because there aren't salmon in the stream that's 100 yards that way anymore. And I knew a woman who was married to a guy from Bangladesh, and he used to tell a story that even 20 years ago, his mother would say to him, I guess 30 years ago now, his mother would say to him, go down to the river and get us some lunch. And he would go fish and he'd bring back a couple fish for lunch. But now the river's so polluted that they buy their fish from Iceland. And that's so why has this exited our discussion? I think for a number of reasons, one of which is that we are even more embedded in and reliant upon the system than we were 50, 60, 70 years ago. And we come to perceive and to experience the system itself as being the source of life, as opposed to, it's like I used to ask, I would go on tour and I would ask students at universities, so what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? And they always interpreted that as, what are you going to do when you have to get a job? It's like, when I go out in the real world, I'm going to roll around in the dirt, you know? It's like, that's the real world. But in everywhere from our experience of food to when we say the real world, what we really mean is capitalism, because it is our real world. Oh, and one more thing about this, which is I love the analysis of John Livingston, who wrote about how cities are not just places of sensory overload, but they're also places of sensory deprivation, because every sensory perception you have is either created or mediated by humans or machines. And if you're constantly surrounded by humans or machines, you come to believe that humans and then machines are the only things that matter. And you come to believe that the real world out there is something abstract. And
this is one of the, just in thinking about this, you've helped me make a link. And that is, you know, we've, in the interior of British Columbia, we've experienced the insect die-offs very viscerally. The boreal forests, right, were, you know, these were the toughest places to inhabit because the bugs are so much more vicious than everywhere but Australia. And you're always encountering the bugs. They're bumping into you. They're hitting your windshield. They're changing, like, even if you're in a car, the bugs are unavoidable. And Most of our bugs are gone now. The windshield is clean when you drive a long distance, and you don't have birds, you don't have insects, you don't have these things that aren't human in your space. And that's just been in the past decade here.
That's horrible. And I just want to, as an outsider, want to validate that back in 1990, I got a wild hair and I decided to drive from, I lived in Spokane, Washington at the time, decided to drive up to the Northwest Territories and just, well, A, it was beautiful. I was so happy. Oh, yeah. There was this one road that was just like 300 miles of dirt road that was with no side roads. And I kept thinking this was the entire continent was like this. You know, it was just unbroken forest. Okay. That was all nice. But every time I got out of my car, I couldn't get out of the car because during the day it's the biting black flies. And at night, it's the mosquitoes. And I got, this is perhaps too much information. But one night I'm sleeping in the back of the car and I really have to get out and pee. So I get out of the car, and in the time it takes me to unzip, pee, zip back up, I get nailed like a half dozen times down there.
Yeah.
I can hear the mosquitoes. The mosquitoes are tapping on the windows.
My friend Kenneth nearly died when he locked his keys in the car in a highway in northern Quebec. He was bleeding so heavily, the blood was obscuring his vision by the time somebody came along and picked him up. So, yeah, it's extraordinary. And that's
they're gone, you say.
Yeah, there's a tiny trace of them. Our mosquitoes have maybe fallen. Our mosquito population, which is one of the ones that has been impacted less, has fallen about 90%.
Wow.
It's really stunning. One doesn't feel quite right moving about in a boreal forest unmolested.
Which has to just have a devastating effect, as you said, on birds and bats.
Yep. Huge declines in our bird population here as well. You are listening to CFUR 88.7 on your FM dial here in Prince George. The show, Missing Peter Zosky in Prince George. I'm your host, Stuart Parker, and we're breaking midway for station identification through an interview with Derek Jensen, the writer, political philosopher, and grassroots environmental activist, who has recently published the book Bright Green Lies through Monkfish Publishers. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit more about people on the land. So I tried to move back to the British Columbia of my youth in 2011 and, of course, discovered you can't really go home. So I took refuge in a town that was most like the British Columbia that I remembered. It used to be that, you know, back when I was the leader of the Green Party, the areas that had the highest green vote were the areas where people were meeting most of their local food needs locally, the upper Robson Valley and the Sunshine Coast, all these sorts of places. They were primarily rural areas. Now, of course, it's a mistake to use people's partisan votes as a way of tracking anything, but I think we can observe that in North America, at least, people who are living at lower population densities, people who are more in touch with the land base, people who are meeting more of their needs self-sufficiently, are the people who have become most likely to support climate denialists at election time, have become the most likely to argue in favor of pseudoscience, the most likely to argue that it doesn't matter if we burn up the earth. And we've seen this real decline in environmental consciousness in the last place where I thought I'd expect it, the areas where we're still in Prince George meeting a lot of our food needs locally in not like in a boutique farmer's markety kind of way. And yet we've seen a dramatic turn to the political right in regions like where I live, even though things seem so much higher stakes in terms of whether people will keep their job or their home or something like that when we have fire tornadoes. What do you make of this turn in rural North America towards the more extreme forms of anti-environmental organizing?
Well, that's another great question. And I'm gonna take a few stabs at it. The first of which is to not disagree, but one hopes finesse. And what I mean by that is that I grew up in much of the rural West, I grew up in just outside of Boulder, Colorado, which was very liberal, but I was just outside. So the farming communities were more conservative. And then in my early 20s, I lived in rural Nevada, rural Idaho. And my experience of the rural areas there was that they were, even at the time, profoundly anti-environmental. And Nevada, especially northeastern Nevada, was a phrase that I heard, not ironically, multiple times, was that if somebody saw any endangered species, they were supposed to follow the three S's, which are shoot, shovel, and shut up. And North Idaho, a lot of logging, a lot of anti-environmentalism. And so I was going to disagree with you, but then I was thinking about some stuff I was writing in a book that's currently at the publisher about marijuana legalization and how rural Northern California, which is where I live now, has been very interesting, a very interesting mix of sort of former loggers who can often be anti-environmental, along with the back to the landers who came here in the 60s, who really started marijuana culture, who were very pro-environment, and then some of their children who were less environmental, and many of whom got seduced by the amount of money they could make growing marijuana. And you end up with this rural, Northern California at least, ends up being this really, really interesting combination of self-sufficiency, libertarianism, and mixed with, in some people, a strong land ethic, and in some people, a strong anti-land ethic. So it ends up being a very mixed thing.
It's very similar to British Columbia 25 years ago, right? Because the people who were in the back to the lander movement, many of them were also Vietnam War resistors. And so there's this tremendous northern migration where you had a lot of three-cornered towns here, is the way I would put it, because there's one little ferry on Vancouver Island that actually epitomizes this, where there's a coastal community and two islands it goes to. One island is Sontula, which has been a hippie communalist town for 120 years. Another island is Alert Bay, which is an Indian reserve. And then the coastal community is Port McNeil, the town that banned Greenpeace and put a price on the head of any Greenpeace protester. And you had, right, the segregated restaurants, the segregated laundromats, where the environmentalists and the native people would go to one and the loggers would go to the other one. And those communities were certainly a site of some of the most extreme anti-environmental views, but they were also our biggest demographic concentrations of environmental concern.
Yeah, and thank you for that. That really illustrates it. And the next part I want to bring to this is an interview I did back in the late 90s of a guy by the name of Joel Dyer, who wrote a book called Harvest of Rage. And his fundamental question was, why did so many, through the whole farm crisis of the 80s and 90s, why did so many of these family farmers end up going hard right? And he sort of took a similar perspective of Michael Moore, who called the Michigan Militia the unemployed arm of the United Auto Workers Union. And so Joel Dyer really blamed the left a lot for this, in that he made the argument that if you're losing your land that you've had for your family's had for 150 years, and you know, we'll leave the fact that the land was stolen in the first place out of it. So you're losing the land, it's been your family for 150 years, and your family's left you, and you're sitting there at your table with an empty bottle of Jack Daniels and a shotgun in your lap, wondering whether or not to put it in your mouth. And somebody knocks on your door and says, "Hey, buddy, let's talk." If that person who knocks on your door is a Mormon, you're going to become a Mormon. If that person who knocks on your door is a right-wing militia member, you're going to become a right-wing militia member. And if that person would have been a lefty, you might have become a lefty. It's like Timothy McVeigh. I saw some of the stuff he wrote about U.S. imperialism, and my God, some of that stuff was just straight out old school lefty. And it's like, where the hell were the lefties when he was in trouble? And so Joel Dyer, he said when he wrote the book, he would ride into town on a motorcycle, and this is back in the 90s in extremely conservative parts of Kansas, Colorado, wherever. He'd ride into town on a motorcycle with his hair down to his butt and wearing an earring, and he would go into the coffee shop where the farmers were sitting and say, "Hey, tell me your story." And he said they didn't care that he was a hippie. It's like here was somebody who was listening to them. And so part of it is been, you know, the left has been much more urban for a while. And don't get me wrong. I have fought loggers, not fought, but I have politically fought loggers, ranchers, farmers for decades. We have been really powerful enemies sometimes. And so I'm not saying they're perfect, but they're still, I got to tell the story. So decades ago, back in the early 90s, one day I was up in, I was living in Spokane, and I went up to a national forest, maybe 80 miles north of where I live, 60 miles, whatever, to get some firewood out of slash piles. And when I'm up there, I get a flat tire, and I haven't checked my spare in years. So I find out my spare is flat too. Like, oh crap, what am I going to do? I'm not going to walk. I'm way the hell out there. So I'm driving along the road at like 1 mile an hour, and I get to this house, and I ask the guy, "Do you have a pump so I can pump up my spare?" And he says, "I don't have a pump, but I'll give you a tire." So he gives me a tire. We put it on the truck, and I drive home. Then my mom makes him a cake. The next day I get my tire fixed, and I drive back up to take his tire back to him. And I give him the cake. He says, "Hey, you want to come in and have a piece?" I say, "Sure." We go in his house. He's got chainsaws all over his wall. And he says, "Hey, as long as you're here, do you want some firewood? I got plenty out back. I'll just cut you up some lengths. We'll throw them in your truck." I say, "Great. That'd be so nice." We got him back. He's standing there holding a chainsaw in his hand. And he says, "By the way, what do you do?" I say, "Well, I'm a writer." He says, "What do you write?" I'm thinking, oh man, science fiction, fantasy, romance. But I'm a terrible liar. And so I just tell him the truth, which is right then I was writing a book about how the big four timber companies got their land illegally from the public domain, railroads and clear cuts. And he starts swearing and turns red in the face. I'm looking for a break in the fence. And then I realize that he's an independent logger who's been put out of business by Plum Creek. And he hates the company even worse than I do, which I didn't think was possible. And so another 30 seconds, and we got our arms around each other's shoulders, just swapping atrocity stories of how much we hate Plum Creek. And then we agree we're going to go against Plum Creek and Potlatch and Boise Cascade and Weyerhaeuser. And then I say, "And by the way, I'm against all forms of industrial logging. So after we take them out, I'm coming after you." And then we both just laugh our asses off because we realize that our difference is fundamentally theoretical. Oh, it's like, yes. Just a couple days ago, I got interviewed by James Howard Kunstler. And he said, "You know, one difference that you and I have is that I want to go basically to a medieval time and you want to go to hunter-gatherer." And so I said, "You know what? Once we take on industrial civilization, when we get to the medieval time, then you and I can have this argument. But in the meantime, doesn't matter." So it's the same. I don't understand why we can't go out and do outreach to, I don't know why I'm shouting, except this makes me so mad. I don't know why we can't do outreach to bloggers or farmers or whomever on specific issues. Oh, one more story, which is one time it was the weirdest thing. A publicist set me up to do an interview, and, you know, they just sort of did a random interview, and I was set up to do the Pittsburgh Pirates baseball postgame show. And I like baseball, but I had no idea. I just call up, you know, I call up the number. It's like, hey, this is Derek Jensen. I say, great, you're on the Pittsburgh Pirates postgame show. Let's talk. Man, I didn't watch the game or anything. So we're like, what are we going to talk about? And both of us were professionals, so we wanted to be able to fill the 15 minutes without embarrassing ourselves. So we quickly started searching for things we could talk about. And what we came to was that Western Pennsylvania has a lot of hunting. So we were arguing that in both in favor that animal rights activists and hunters should work together to protect habitat. And then the animal rights activists can try to sabotage the hunts. And the point is, it's like, there's this thing on the left that just annoys me no end. It's the, my friend of mine calls it the cooties theory of politics, where you can't talk to anybody who has impure thoughts. Because if you talk to anybody that you disagree with on any issues, that means you can never talk to them about other issues. One more story about that. There's a guy I used to talk to sometimes who ran a computer store here in Crescent City. And when I would go in, if we got to talking about politics, I would never talk about salmon because I knew he didn't care. What I would talk about are the effects of big box stores on small businesses because Walmart was driving them out of business. So you can always find something that, even if they're really hardcore right wing, you can find a way to get in if you're not going to worry about purity politics.
Well, you were recommended for this show. I'm an appallingly ill-read man. You were recommended for this show by Art Vandenberg. He was the first person elected as a Green Party city councillor in Canadian history. He's one of these solar folks you disagree with. He really wanted to have you on the show, primarily, I think, to talk about this, that our sense of how to build coalitions, we actually don't understand that that's a thing we should try to do. And I, in the 1990s, we nearly got proportional representation. We nearly got a major electoral change in this province because we built a coalition of environmentalists, communists, the Christian right, and the neo-Jeffersonian taxpayer movement. And it was easily the most harmonious working experience of my whole political life because we had very few things to talk about. We knew what we were talking about and what we were not talking about. And we had this annual ritual where Troy Lanigan, the head of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, would be our president every year. And the nominating speech for his presidency would always be given by the leader of the Marxist-Leninist Party. There is that idea, and there's this very different theory of contagion. Tempting to talk about the contagion. I think I'll bring you back another time in a few months to talk about that because I've been wanting to get back to Nader. So Ralph Nader, obviously, fans of tactical voting, will, you know, hate him forever because of 2000 or whatever and the Al Gore election. But Ralph Nader made the practical judgment call, endorsed the Biden-Harris ticket this time. And I'm wondering, there was an American Green Party, ran Howie Hawkins' last presidential election. Here we just, the Green Party held the balance of power in our legislature for 3 years. During their last budget vote, they voted for a 26% increase in fracking. They also voted to double the allowable annual cut, double the number of mining vehicles on the road, and support a number of other surprising things, including a local plastics plant here in Prince George. I've, for that and other reasons, I've grown a little soured on electoral politics, and I'm just interested in your take. A lot of people like Nader and Chomsky threw in for electoral politics, mainstream electoral politics, for the first time in decades. Whereas others of us are moving away from it. What sort of place do you see electoral politics as having at this point in challenging the extinction event?
Well, thanks again for another great question. And I have a two-part answer. Okay, so I believe that it can be really important to vote locally because I live in a fairly small area, and you can have, I do believe that you can make a difference. And a great example of this is that 10 years ago, we were fighting, some guy was going to come in and put in a subdivision in this fairly forested neighborhood. And we fought him at the local level, just using, you know, the planning council, board of supervisors. And we were able to stop him by a 3-2 vote on the board of supervisors. And had he done it 2 years later, when the supervisors were changed, the next round we would have lost because a pro-developer guy got in. And so on a local level, I do believe it can make a difference when you're having, you know, total number of ballots cast in my district is 1,000. Okay. But on a bigger scale, I love this by corporate anthropologist Jane Ann Morris. She wrote, "Corporate persons have constitutional rights to due process and equal protection that human persons, affected citizens, don't have. For non-corporate human citizens, there's a democracy theme park where we can pull levers on voting machines and talk into microphones at hearings. But don't worry, they're not connected to anything and nobody's listening except for us. What regulatory law regulates is citizen input, not corporate behavior." And so I think on the larger scale, I think it's for the most part, like she says, a democracy theme park. And I know that so my own voting history is actually kind of fun because, okay, I'm going to say something. I don't want you to hang up on me for being impure. In 1980, I voted for Ronald Reagan when I was 19, because he said he was going to balance the budget, and everybody in the newspaper said this was important. And of course, he didn't balance the budget. So it was a really, because my vote didn't matter. If we won by one vote, I'd kill myself. But because my vote essentially didn't matter, it was a nice learning experience that I was late to the party, but politicians lie. You know, he made a campaign promise that the day after the election, nobody cared. Okay, well, I understand how this works now. Okay, 84, I think I either voted Democrat or I was away from home and not able to vote. 88, I think I voted Democrat. And then here's the point. 91, George Bush Sr. said that he was going to weaken the Endangered Species Act, which is a third rail for me. That is outrageous and unacceptable. Clinton said that's terrible. So yay, Clinton. And then he got in, and instead of weakening the Endangered Species Act, he administratively weakened it through funding processes. And it's like, oh, I get it. And ever since then, I have understood that the entire, at least in the United States, the entire two-party system is good cop, bad cop. And Bill Clinton will feel your pain as he signs into effect NAFTA. And the only argument that the Democrats have had for the past 30 years, and my mom, she died a couple years ago at 86, she said she remembered a time when the Democrats actually were working class party. And don't know if that's romance or if that's real, but in any case, I have not experienced that in my lifetime. And so the only argument they've had is at least we're not Republicans. And that really, I thought that was absurd many years ago, but in 2016 and 2020, it's gone way over the top that they were explicit. I mean, Biden stinks, but at least he's not Trump. I mean, that was basically their campaign slogan. Mm-hmm. And so I can't speak to other nations because I don't know them. I can't speak to Canada. I can't speak to Mexico. I can't speak to the UK, but in the United States, I loved what Chris Hedges said, that Yes, Donald Trump is a creation of this whole wretched system, but Biden helped design it. And basically, that's what we end up with, is somebody who will just outright say, no, I'm going to screw you over, or somebody who's going to say, you know, I'm going to feel your pain as I screw you over.
And I think ultimately people are finding the I'll feel your pain as I screw you over less narratively compelling. I think that a lot of people, it was a great observation here, because we had a government that was bending over backwards to win back rural industrial British Columbia, which is what the New Democratic Party had originally come from. It was a party of mine workers and mill workers back in the day. And they, right, they gave $6 billion in new subsidies to the fossil fuel industry. They gave $1 billion to Royal Dutch Shell. They turned our police force into a brute squad to push Royal Dutch Shell's pipeline through. And then in the riding where they'd invested their $1 billion of public money to build this giant liquefied natural gas plant, which of course they claim they're going to use to save the planet, and why we needed to increase fracking so much. But their vote went down in this town. They'd spent $1 billion to get back. And I was asking my political panel on the radio, like, what do you make of this? Why did the BC Liberal Party, which is really not even a liberal party, it's the party of the right here, why did their vote, when they ran this disastrous campaign, there was a huge swing against them, why did their vote go up in all the industrial towns? And the response was, nobody wants to vote for people who are apologetically doing something. They want to vote for people who are enthusiastically doing something. And there is that problem with, I would say, the current progressive sales pitch, which is that it's an apologetic sales pitch for the omnicide rather than Donald Trump making it the doctrine of the U.S. government that they were trying to achieve the 7-degree hothouse warming intentionally.
I know for myself, I would rather oppose. I find it easier to oppose the Republicans than Democrats for that reason, because of that openness as opposed to the sort of sneakiness.
Yeah. So unfortunately, we're pretty much out of time. I want to thank you so much for hollowing out, the time you have to spend, on the show. Are there any sort of concluding observations you want to make, or one last book pitch?
So final book push. The most recent book is Bright Green Lies. It is either out or just out. I mean, it's either just out or it will be out very shortly. It's about how wind and solar won't save the planet. And there are things people can – if I can just do another minute. There are things that people can do when we talk about basically how nature sequesters carbon really well. And if we just stop – sort of, for me, the central image of the book is, if you have, or one of the central images is a character, if somebody's brought into the hospital and they're bleeding out from a bazillion wounds and all the nurses and doctors are putting bandages on, and this is what environmentalists are doing. We're trying to put band-aids everywhere to stop the serial killer from continuing to stab the body. And what we really need to do, if we want to stop the murder of the planet, we have to stop the murder of the planet.
Right. Yes. I do remember somebody saying, wouldn't it be great if there were some technology that could pull carbon out of the atmosphere? And it's like, yes, indeed. Wouldn't that be great? Like perhaps a tree or something.
Or grass or seagrass or mangroves, marshes. Yep. Yep. They can do miracles. I want to leave us on a positive note, which is there are more than 450 dead zones in the oceans. And that's not the positive note yet. More than 450 dead zones in the oceans, one of which has recovered. And it was the worst one. It was in the Black Sea. And the reason it recovered is because when the Soviet Union collapsed, it was no longer economically feasible to do agriculture along the shores of the Black Sea right there. And within 20 years, that dead zone had recovered enough that they had an industrial fishery there.
Wow. That is a cheering note. Unexpected danger and unexpected resilience.
Yep.
So anyway, thanks again for coming on the show. Hope we can have you back in a few months.
Thanks. I would love that.
This has been another broadcast of Missing Peter Zosky in Prince George on CFUR 88.7, co-sponsored by Los Altos Institute, losaltos.ca.
Your father's gone a-hunting, he's deep in the forest so wild, and he cannot take his wife with him, he cannot take his child. Your father's gone a-hunting, in the quicksand and the clay, and a woman cannot follow him, although she knows the way. Your father's gone a-hunting through the silver and the glass, where only greed can enter, but spirit, spirit cannot pass. Your father's gone a-hunting for the beast he'll never bind, and he leaves a baby sleeping and his blessings all behind. Your father's gone a-hunting, and he's lost his lucky charm, and he's lost the guardian heart that keeps the hunter from the harm. Your father's gone a-hunting, he asked me to say goodbye, and he warned me not to stop. I wouldn't even try.